I'm the daughter of the chief. Tribal law betroths me to our leader. If there's another, I will step aside.
No, Miramane, there's no one else in my mind or my heart.
Bridge to all decks and incoming Enterprise incidents with Scott and Steve. I'm Scott Mance.
And I am Kirok. And I'm Steve Morris.
I always anticipate what kind of clever opening is Steve Morris going to do this week on Enterprise Incidents. And once again, he did not disappoint. We are very, very excited to do our deep dive into a very special episode, not just of the third season of the original series, but of Star Trek overall. From start to finish, The Paradise Syndrome, the other Star Trek episode with the word paradise in it, is a beauty to behold. And joining us as our very, very, very special guest for our deep dive conversation of The Paradise Syndrome, she has been a guest instructor on film history and appreciation. She taught a six-hour lecture on the films of Ingmar Bergman at UC Riverside. She has been an executive at Sony Pictures for more than 15 years and worked on third-party partnership campaigns for movies like Into the Spider-Verse and a little film that came out last December called Spider-Man No Way Home, which is an amazing movie. And she is also a very dear friend of mine. And she is also, just like me and Steve and everyone listening to Enterprise Incidents, a crazy diehard Star Trek TOS fan.
Yes.
Welcome, Becky Deanna.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, the first time that Scott and I met, we realized we had the same ringtone. And then it was the Star Trek communicator sound. And I'm like, this is a friendship that's going to last for a long time.
I remember I was in Becky's office and my text alert went off and it's the communicator sound. Yeah. And Becky looked at her phone and she goes, is that you or me? And we're like, oh my God, we have the same like alert on
our
text.
Yeah, it was the alert, not ringtone. Yeah, exactly.
But Becky, I don't think I ever asked you, like, what was the one Star Trek episode that made you specifically a fan of the original series?
Oh gosh, I think it was Devil in the Dark, probably.
Good one.
Can't go wrong with that.
Yeah. And obviously The City on the Edge of Forever. Those are my top two favorite episodes. The love story, I love it. And then this has got an amazing love story, so I can't wait to talk about that as well. But and then Erin of Mercy is my third favorite episode. But
wow, you have excellent taste.
Oh, thank you very much.
By the way, having now heard your bio, I keep thinking about what is the crossover between Ingmar Bergman and Star Trek? And I actually think There's a whole bunch there we could probably find.
I think so. I mean, Ingmar Bergman's all about the human condition and love for humanity, and so is Star Trek. So there, a lot of people think that he's bleak, but he really does love humanity and wants to reveal it to the people that watch his films. And I just think that they have a really nice thread between them.
Well, Becky, what is it about the Paradise Syndrome in particular that you love about it? Because I remember when I asked you to join us, you're like, oh, yes, I love that episode. Why?
Oh, because I know some people criticize William Shatner for over-emoting in this episode, but I just think he's so wonderful. He's so wonderful. And I just think the love story, when he genuinely looks like he is in love. And when there's that scene when they're running through the forest, and they're just so happy and he's realizing how happy he is. It seems so genuine. I love it so much. And it's really effective.
And absolutely.
Yeah. I think that's it. And he's also very dreamy in that scene as well.
What about you, Steve? What is it about the Paradise Syndrome that you like?
Well, you're assuming that I like it.
Yes, I am.
Oh.
And you're correct. I do. I actually really like it a lot. I've always liked this one. I think for a couple of different reasons. One is that it's just so different. The whole feel of it is really different. And while I am going to be one of those people that is not a fan of a couple of Shatner moments in this, I actually totally agree, Becky. For the most part, he just looks like he's in love. I think his performance is fantastic, except for those one or two places that I think it's not. Yeah.
Well, that's a really good point. You know, when I was doing my rewatch of The Paradise Syndrome, which, by the way, if this is an episode that I've always loved, one that I always felt was very special, very unique. There really isn't another episode of the original series like it, but it's not one that I've gone back to over and over again, like the episodes, Becky, that you just mentioned as your favorites, which I have gone back to over and over again. But what I really love about The Paradise Syndrome is, like, it's the only episode of season three, other than briefly All Our Yesterdays, where it's open, where they went outside, they went on location. You could tell that everyone on the production staff at Star Trek knew that this was a very special episode, and it is, because they pulled out all the stops for it. Mm-hmm. But like you said, it's a beautiful love story. Like, you really feel like Kirk, or rather like Kirok, loves Miramani. And I think William Shatner's performance in this episode, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's a 9.8. And it just, like, the back and forth with what's going on in the Enterprise and what's going on the planet, the fact that this is the only episode of the original series to take place over an extended period of time, which is like 2 months. And I was really thinking about it this time, rewatching it. It finally hit me, Becky and Steve. This episode, The Paradise Syndrome, would make a great companion, a great, like, cousin episode to one episode of The Next Generation. Can you guess which episode I'm talking about?
Inner Light?
Inner Light, I was thinking that one too.
You both, this is why you are both like the perfect hosts for The Paradise Syndrome. Yes, because just like Kirk has this whole life, well, at least for 2 months, Picard had this whole life in the Inner Light. And, you know, there's flashes back to the Enterprise. It really is. They're really great companion episodes. But this episode is also The Paradise Syndrome. It is the first of 5 episodes in season 3 to be directed by Judd Taylor. Judd Taylor directed more season 3 episodes than any other director. He directed 5 season 3 episodes. Also, The Wink of an Eye, Let That Be Your Last, Battlefield, The Mark of Gideon, and The Cloudminders. And he wound up replacing Michael O'Herlihy, who was the director of Tomorrow Is Yesterday, because he jumped ship to direct a movie for Disney called Smith that no one ever heard from again. He is a one-time president of the Directors Guild. He's an Emmy nominee for Outstanding Directing in a special program for Tail Gun Runner. The Paradise Syndrome is the second Star Trek episode written by Margaret Armin, who wrote her story outline on March 15th, 1968, when it was called The Pale Face. She proceeded to a second draft teleplay on May 18th. Arthur Singer did a rewrite, a final draft, on June 3rd. And then while the episode was actually in production, Fred Freiberger, the executive producer, did some page revisions on June 5th, 7th, and 10th. And about a week after production ended, the title was finally changed from The Pale Face to The Paradise Syndrome, because Gene Roddenberry did not like the original title. He said it wasn't, quote, imaginative or provocative enough. Mm-hmm. This is one of the many instances, Becky and Steve, where you will hear that Gene Roddenberry's instincts, even though he did kind of distance himself a little, he was still very much involved, just like he was in the first season, made a lot of really, really great creative decisions. The Paradise Syndrome aired on October 4th, 1968. It was the 58th episode to air, but it was the 59th episode to film, on schedule in 6 days between June 11th and June 18th. But Becky and Steve, as you can imagine, just by the look of this episode, it went way over budget. The final cost for The Paradise Syndrome was $193,627, making it more than $15,000 over its budget. Yeah, more than $15,000 over the budget of $178,362. This was the final score to be composed by Gerald Freed, who, of course, composed the scores for Shore Leave and A Mock Time. The score was recorded on June 19th, 1968. And just a quick personal story about Gerald Freed. In December of 2012, there was a special screening of 2 episodes that Gerald Freed scored for the release of the 15 CD box set of all the music from the original series. So Gerald Fried played the flute that you hear at the beginning of the score for this episode, and he did it live and in person.
Wow.
And yeah, it was quite the moment.
You know, I was thinking about the budget, and it's like, yes, they went 10 grand or 15 grand over budget. That's still less than 10%. And if you compare it to the first season, man, they got a lot out of that amount of money. You know what I mean?
They did, sure.
I think this would have looked good in any season, not just the third season.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't that much going on in the world, at least not that I read about for this week. But I will tell you some of the things, which is it was filmed between the 11th and 18th of June, 1968. And that on the 12th, after wrapping production, the crew of the Enterprise might have head off to a movie theater to watch the premiere of Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, good one.
So that would have been pretty freaky. On the 13th, and the only reason I bring this one up is that it just shows we continue to deal with the same things in the world, which is that on June 13th, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren, announced his retirement to Johnson. And the reason he did was because of Robert Kennedy's assassination. Suddenly, the odds of Nixon being president went way up, and he wanted a Democrat to appoint his successor. So he said he was going to retire. LBJ wanted Abe Fortas to be the next Supreme Court Chief Justice. Couldn't get it done in time. There was a lot of controversy over that nomination. It was Richard Nixon who put Chief Justice Burger on the court. And so I only bring this up to go, we are still fighting over justices and the makeup of the Supreme Court. And then this one is not actually Star Trek related, but it sounds Star Trek related, which is that on June 14th, Dr. Benjamin Spock was convicted in Boston, which I had totally forgotten about this. He was conspiring to help young men avoid the draft, and he was sentenced to 2 years in prison, but that sentence was suspended on the appeal. And that is what was going on when they were filming this episode of Star Trek.
Becky, over the years, how many times has someone like picked up on your love for Star Trek and said, oh yeah, that's Dr. Spock. And you had to say, no, it's Mr. Spock. Dr. Spock is someone else.
a few times. And I, you know what I get a lot is people that assume that I like that Star Wars. They're, oh, look, I'm wearing a Star Wars shirt. Aren't you excited? And I'm like, that's Star Trek that I'm into, not Star Wars.
Yeah.
It happens all the time. Or people call it Star Trek, which is always I flinch.
That's a pet peeve. It's not Star Trek. It's Star Trek.
You know, what's funny. A Pale Face sounds like an Ingmar Bergman title of one of his films. It's kind of funny. I'm like, that seems like that would be a Bergman film.
You're really kind of funny. Yeah.
I'm real glad they changed that title.
Yeah.
Not only is that title not age well, but it also doesn't fit the show. Yeah. It's not actually what the show's about.
Yep.
Speaking of which, shall we get into the Paradise Syndrome?
Let's beam down to the planet. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
This planet actually has a name, even though we don't hear it mentioned throughout the episode. The planet is mentioned in the screenplay. The final draft screenplay has the name of this planet, and it is called, talk about being too on the nose. The name of the planet in the Paradise Syndrome is Amerind. Amerind. So take American Indian and take the first few letters of each, and there you have Amerind.
Well, it's good that it was never mentioned.
Yes. Yes.
We start in the teaser, and Scott, as you said, this looks like nothing else. We're looking at this beautiful lake. We're hearing that flute, and that is the composer playing that?
That's Gerald Fried. That's correct.
And it just looks, there's a very soft filter on it. It looks very different. And then you hear that sound of the transporter, and there are three guys beaming down onto the planet.
And Steve, you and I have talked about this many times before, where we hear something before we see it. Like in Apocalypse Now, when you hear Kurtz's voice before you actually see Marlon Brando as Kurtz. So the way that this episode starts with the beautiful music and the scenery and the trees and the lake, and the camera slowly pans to the right, and you hear this sound that must be the transporter. And then finally, our three figures beam into play, and there are Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And you go, okay, yep, this is a Star Trek episode.
They're just wondering at the beauty of the place they're in. And it really is an incredible location. Scott, do you have where this was actually filmed?
Of course. I'm so glad you asked, Steve Morris. Even though it does look like they filmed it in the Catskills, they actually filmed it in Upper Franklin Canyon near the Hollywood Hills. They shot there for 3 straight days. Now, the problem with that is that despite the look, the scenic beauty of it in this episode, it was actually pretty noisy because there were roads close by. So all of the dialogue had to be re-recorded and looped into the episode itself. And there are times where you can see that they did just that. And like Becky, do you remember like when you saw this episode for the first time, was it something where you liked it all right at first, but it grew on you, or did you like it right away?
I think I liked it right away just because I love wildly romantic episodes and just like City on the Edge of Forever. So this one just got me. But it seemed very familiar. I mean, it's what they now call the Santa Monica Mountains, which is where they shot it. So it felt very, it felt like home when you watched it. And I love the opening scene where they're just in awe of this idyllic place.
Look at those pine trees.
And that lake.
I swear that's honeysuckle I smell.
I swear that's a little orange blossom thrown in.
Well, and it feeling like home is exactly what they're talking about because they say it looks exactly like Earth. And then we hear, what are the odds of that duplication?
How many times have we heard that? Astronomical. It's like, once again, Hodgkin's law of parallel development comes into play. And after Stan Robertson, the standards and practices person at NBC who was in charge of Star Trek, mandated no more parallel Earth episodes. You had Spectre of the Gun, which, you know, kind of sort of is a Western. And now you have, a parallel development. What are the odds?
I mean, going, we don't want any parallel Earths. And then we're like, cowboys and Indians, you know? it all goes to, we haven't met them yet, but I really do wish they had just made this like Friday's Child or Private Little War. It's like you could have a primitive culture without making it a parallel culture, but the episode totally works for me. So it doesn't bother me as much, but it definitely is strange coming off of season 2. But the first thing we see is this really, I think, beautifully designed obelisk. And I'm guessing this is a big hunk of the budget too.
Yeah.
This is a big hunk of the budget. So much so that when they should have beamed down a whole lot of security people to look for Captain Kirk, the only people there are Kirk, are Spock and McCoy. But the obelisk, of course, the obelisk was designed by Matt Jeffries, the set designer who designed the Enterprise and the Klingon ship and all the sets and the bridge and everything. This guy was a genius. And the obelisk was actually made out of plexiglass, but it looks a lot more expensive than that. And of course, why are we even on this planet to begin with?
If we are to divert the asteroid, which is on a collision course with this planet, we must warp out of orbit within 30 minutes.
I just love how casual.
Yes.
Right? You know, they're like, oh, we'll get around to it.
You did say 30 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Then let's go. Let's find out what life forms are blessed by this environment.
Yeah, and it's like, how come they didn't have this conversation before they landed? Like, I love how he's like, how much time do we have to investigate? I'm like, shouldn't we have talked about this before we landed? Like, we have 30 minutes. We need to get going. Not like strolling around and checking everything out.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a whole planet survival we're talking about. I would go like, why not deflect the asteroid first and check out the place later?
Maybe he wanted to see if there's what they were actually saving. Maybe.
But we do head over to see the local inhabitants, and there we see what looks exactly like a Hollywood version of a Native American village circa mid-60s. That's what we're looking at here.
But I think it's actually a nice shot that you...
Beautiful shot.
Right? Yeah. You're seeing across the lake, and you're watching Kirk and Spock and McCoy just kind of like standing by the trees, just like they're just sort of taking in the moment, especially Kirk. Now, here's my question for you, Becky. Mm-hmm. Don't you think that the Kirk that we see in this episode is closer to the version of Kirk that we saw in the first half of the first season when he was overburdened and longing for a simpler life?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, he seems like he wants to take it all in and relax, and there's a lot weighing on him.
And Steve, I wonder like what this episode would have looked like if Gene Kuhn actually produced it.
It's a good, honestly, I don't want to mess with this episode. I think it's a good point. The thing that I was just thinking about, because I totally agree. I think we're definitely dealing with themes that were very much part of the first season. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking about this idea of continuity and if things continued from episode to episode. And what I'm going now is, well, what just happened? What just happened was Ilan of Troyes cried on him and he once again fell in love and then once again had his duty force him to give up that love. And at the end, McCoy, who had a cure to the tears, didn't give it to him because Spock said, oh, the Enterprise cured him, which it didn't, which means that Kirk is still feeling that lost love. And now here he is on this planet, having had to make another sacrifice to his duty. It makes a lot of sense why he's going, this looks beautiful. Like, what? Imagine having a life like this. You know?
That's a really good point. We don't know if McCoy actually ever gave him the antidote to the tears from the Domain of Alas. And here he is on a planet still probably affected in some ways, not just by her, but it was exhausting having to fight the Klingons at impulse power. So He's probably like, man, I wish I could just stay here and check out.
and remember, what are the most famous words about what Kirk doesn't have? No beach to walk on.
No beach to walk on.
We're right on this lake.
And we're on the beach.
What's the matter, Jim?
What? Oh, nothing. Just so peaceful. Uncomplicated. No problems. No command decisions. Just living.
Aw, just want to let him have it.
It's like, dude, you take a personal day. Exactly.
But let's deflect the asteroid first.
Fair. Good plan. And I like that McCoy calls this the Tahiti syndrome.
Why not just call it the Paradise syndrome?
There you go.
Yeah.
And I also, by the way, a really nice directorial choice is we're talking about this idea of, it's particularly common to tortured leader types like starship captains. The camera is just pushing in on Kirk.
Yeah.
And that is such a great directorial choice of like, we're not looking at the people talking. We're listening to them and we're looking at what's important, which is the effect that this environment is having on Kirk.
What's your take, Becky, on just how like all the teasers for the original series are just so great? I mean, when you compare the teasers of the original series to all the later Trek shows, I'm not to slam them at all, but there is nothing like a teaser for the original series. But this one really is different. Like you really feel the scope of Kirk's longing for something simpler. You're matching his burden with the peaceful nature of his surroundings.
Right. And I feel like, so much happens in the first 6 minutes. It's so much. Like, it's just, you're watching it and it's this massive amounts of dialogue and they see the Native Americans and then they see the obelisk and everything. And it's, it really sets the scene. It's much more than you write a current Star Trek episode would. You really feel like you're in for something special already when you land on that planet.
Let's go take care of that asteroid. But first, I want another look at that obelisk.
And we should say that on this obelisk, there are all these symbols all along the walls, and he's examining them, and then he calls up to the Enterprise.
Kirk to Enterprise.
Yes, sir.
And a big hole opens up below him, and he falls down into the obelisk, stands up dazed, and as he stands up, he hits a button or something, and something hits him, and he passes out. And that is the end of the teaser.
Now, in early versions, Kirk touches the obelisk. He touches it, and that's what makes it open. And when he falls, he hits his head, and that's how he gets amnesia. And this is another moment where Roddenberry's instincts came in for the better, because he was the one that suggested for Kirk to fall through the trapdoor and accidentally activate alien machinery, which causes him to lose his memory. Oh, you hit your head, you bump your head, you get amnesia. That's such a trope. But in this case, hitting your head was being zapped in the head by this alien technology. And that is why he lost his memory.
That is really smart. I mean, the hitting your head amnesia, that's like Gilligan's Island.
Yep.
And I have another thought about it that I'm going to bring up at the end that didn't occur to me until just now. But I'm going to save it till we get to the end, because I actually think that change might relate to several other episodes that we'll talk about it like when we get there.
Numerous search parties and repeated sensor probes of the area have failed to locate Captain Kirk.
Spock to Enterprise.
Enterprise, come in, Mr. Spock.
Prepare to beam us up, Mr. Scott. We're warping out of orbit.
And McCoy is mad.
McCoy is furious. Yeah. He's like, what are you talking about, beam up? And see, this is, Becky, is it just like the sort of the classic moment, the classic type of scene where Spock wants to do one thing and McCoy wants to do something else? And like, doesn't a moment like this really just sort of define what we actually do love about this relationship between Spock and McCoy?
Yes. And actually, all three of the leads, they all have such different acting styles and such different personalities. And it just always works so complementary towards each other. Their different relationships between each other is amazing. And I love how Spock has to explain to him with the rocks. Like, he has to dumb it down for McCoy. This is the rock. And this is what the asteroid is. It's pretty funny.
And I think this is, you know, this is Spock, the leader that he has grown into since Galileo 7, is that he knows that he needs McCoy on his team. Like, he could just say, my orders are beam up, but he's going to take that extra 30 seconds to get McCoy on his side, which McCoy reluctantly agrees. They beam up.
The way that Spock and McCoy beam back to the Enterprise, you don't see the close-up of the two figures beaming up. You see them beam up from a distance. So imagine you were one of the natives on this planet and you were just like walking through, walking past the tree towards the obelisk, and you saw these two figures disappear and you went, are my eyes playing tricks on me? What was that? And then you shrug it off. Like, I often wondered, like, if Miramani and the person she was with might have actually caught that, but, you know, nothing is ever mentioned of it.
And then Kirk wakes up. And we hear not a captain's log, but just voiceover.
Where am I? What place is this?
Which I wonder, Scott, I'm curious if that some of that was added later or if it was another rewrite. That would have been my guess.
Well, Steve, your instincts are right on point. After principal photography on this episode was finished, there were a couple of moments where executive producer Fred Freiberger felt like, you know what? I think we just need a little something to just make the obvious a little more obvious. And those two moments came right now when Kirk has amnesia, because Shatner's spot on performance, walking around in a daze, picking up his phaser and his communicator, not knowing what they are, wasn't enough. And the other is when Kirok is saying to himself, I have found paradise. And I'm on team Blade Runner, the director's cut, where the voiceover was taken out. So I think I would have liked to have seen this episode without the voiceover. What do you think, Becky?
I think so. That would have been interesting. Yeah, sometimes it's sometimes when there's a voiceover, I like it because it seems very literary. But I don't know, and that just seems like more intellectual to me. But I think it would have been nice. So I don't think we needed it for Kirk's innermost thoughts. I think we could tell that he didn't understand what his phaser and communicator were. And then also it also just shows like the chaos of like that he doesn't know where he is, because we don't know where he is. So it's nice that to not hear his thoughts in that moment. It would have been interesting.
What about you, Steve?
I 100% am on team Blade Runner, no narration, director's cut. And for several reasons, which is it has to do with how much you trust your audience. And it also has to do in filmmaking. There's times where you need all of your audience, 100% of them, to understand something right now. And there are other things where it's like, well, some of the audience is going to get it now and some of the audience will get it a little bit later, but all of the audience will get it eventually. Is that him looking at his communicator and his phaser? A lot of the audience would have gone, oh, I think maybe something's wrong with his memory, but not all of the audience. But by the time he gets to the scene and with the rest of the Native Americans or whatever they are, with the villagers, then when he says, it's foggy for me, all of the audience would have gotten up to speed. And that is, it definitely goes into the ideas of show, don't tell, is having voiceover say, well, I don't know who I am. Well, now you just told the audience everything, rather than having them be with Kirk and experience it emotionally as we go along. It would have been way stronger without that voiceover.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I completely agree.
But this is also, do you trust your audience? You know, and because if they don't get it, well, the whole episode fails. And so that's, I'm sure, why they looked at, we're at a big network show for the lowest common denominator. Let's just tell him and be safe.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a real powerful scene when you see him reemerge from the obelisk, because you can see how they think he's a god. It does very much look like he's coming from this thing, this temple that they worship. I think that's a really powerful scene.
I agree. I think that you know the way that you see Kirk rising from the obelisk, and he's wearing something that looks absolutely nothing like what the natives are wearing. And again, I cannot say enough about Gerald, the effectiveness at Gerald Fried's score. And it was so effective that, you know, there are some episodes where they do a score and they reuse it in other episodes. Very, very little of the score was repurposed for some of the later episodes of the third season, because the score was so unique to the setting, and it had to be. But you're right, Becky, when Kirk emerges, like, I mean, I know I'm watching a TV show, but he looks like a god to me.
Yeah, I would have been like, huh?
Well, and the people that see him, they're two women, one of whom we're going to get to know very well is Miramani.
Miramani, played by Sabrina Scharf. She was a former Playboy bunny, and she was on TV shows like Gidget, Mannix, Hogan's Heroes, and Hawaii Five-0. And on film, she was in two movies in the 60s that starred or co-starred Jack Nicholson. One was Hell's Angels on Wheels. The other is Easy Rider.
Easy Rider is among the most important films that I don't like.
You don't like Easy Rider?
No.
Why?
Not a fan.
Why?
Too chaotic. There are amazing scenes in it, particularly the Jack Nicholson sitting around the fire scene is an amazing scene. There are other amazing scenes. I think it's a super important film in terms of New Hollywood, but it's not a movie I'd like to sit down and watch.
It's not one you covered on the Cinephiles.
John doesn't like it either, so I doubt we'll ever do it on the Cinephiles.
Are you an Albert Brooks fan? No, I just think I said I wondered if he's an Albert Brooks fan, because he very much influenced Lost in America, because they talk about Easy Rider so much in that movie.
I like Lost in America so much more than I like Easy Rider.
I agree.
Lost in America is hilarious.
A masterpiece.
I love them both.
But this is not the Albert Brooks / Dennis Hopper, Peter Fonda podcast. This is a Star Trek podcast. It is a Star Trek podcast. I think we need to head back up to the Enterprise, where Spock is pushing. I'm assuming they spent more than 30 minutes because they're looking for Kirk, because now they're really pushing the warp engines. And Scotty is grumpy that they're pushing him too hard and we can't maintain warp 9 much longer. And I just want to point out that what Spock is doing is exactly what Kirk has done over and over and over again, which is push the Enterprise beyond what everyone else thinks it can do, except everyone's cool with Kirk doing it. No one is cool with Spock doing it.
But has Kirk pushed the Enterprise quite the way that Spock is pushing the Enterprise? Especially, you know, Scotty's kind of really freaking out in engineering, and we really see the effect of them pushing the Enterprise on the warp engines. Now, you know, we've seen Kirk, you know, push the Enterprise past the speed, especially in like Arena when the alien is going to the next level. And then Kirk says, you know, warp factor 8, and everybody turns around and looks at him. But you're right. Like, why does Kirk sort of get off the hook? But Spock is definitely under the glare of everyone because he's pushing the Enterprise for a worthy reason.
Maybe it's his temperament.
A, I think it's that. I think people have just trusted Kirk. And B, I think Kirk has gotten lucky over and over again, and Spock does not get lucky. Aww. We're back on the planet in the village. We're in like a hut, and there is the elder, like the tribal elder, and the medicine chief, Salish, talking to Kirk.
Again, a character we don't hear the name of mentioned during the episode itself, but in the screenplay, his name is Goro, and he is played by Richard Hale, who had been acting for decades, going back to the early 50s in TV shows like Family Theater, Four Star Playhouse, and then later in the 60s with Maverick, Wagon Train, Rawhide, Perry Mason, and Bonanza. And on film, he was in Julius Caesar and also in the classic To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm-hmm. With him is Salish, played by Rudy Solari, who was on TV in shows like The Outer Limits, Mission Impossible, Police Story, and Into the 80s with Quincy M.E.
And the first thing they're trying to confirm is that they heard from Miramani that he came out of the temple, but they need to be sure. And this is where I think we would have understood that Kirk's having memory issues, because he says,
"I'll answer anything I can, but as I told you, many things are strange to me."
Salish, the medicine chief, is immediately dismissive and distrustful of Kirk.
He knows nothing of our danger. How can he save us?
Yeah, he's the Styles of this episode.
Yes, exactly. And I like he interrupts, and he gets shut down.
It is against custom to interrupt the tribal elder at council, even for the medicine chief.
Elder, words will not save us when the skies darken. I say he must prove he is a god.
Well, Salish, you know, that's his purpose. He is the medicine chief, but he has also been the chosen one to protect the people when the skies darken and the winds howl. And this was something that I didn't quite pick up until this viewing, but Salish's father knew how to get into the temple to activate it, to deflect whatever is coming to the planet to maybe smash it. But his father died before he can tell Salish how to get inside and how to activate the mechanism. So he still considers himself the god, the medicine chief, but when push comes to shove, he doesn't know better than anyone else how to get into that obelisk.
Did you feel like the impression was that his dad didn't think he was ready to tell him yet? I said I thought that it was sort of alluded to that. And I feel kind of bad for Salish a little bit because he ends up getting his like girlfriend taken away and his job.
Oh, are you kidding? I felt totally bad for Salish. He's got it made, at least until
his dad trusts him with this important information. Come on.
Yeah. And that's a really good point. I mean, I definitely felt bad for him for the turn of events that led to him losing his job and his intended other.
Yeah.
But as for maybe why he wasn't taught how to get in, I never considered that. But that sounds pretty legit to me. What about you, Steve?
So I 100% had the thought that that dad was withholding it for a reason, yeah, that Salish had disappointed him on some level. I also think, dad, this is a really bad plan. The whole idea that only one dude is going to know how to save the planet in a primitive world, people die all the time. Like that's a bad plan. Third thing, it's funny. We're coming off of Elan of Troyes. I have similar feelings about Salish as Elan, which is, he's kind of a jerk, so it's not like I like the guy.
Yeah,
but he didn't ask for this. His life was all set, and this weird dude just comes in. Yeah, I totally feel sympathetic.
Yeah, in a second, your job is now this person's job. Your whole identity is now taken.
But we're in this moment where somehow he's got to prove he's a god, and Kirk doesn't even know who he is. And right in this moment, what happens? But in comes a man with this boy that has gotten tangled in the nets while fishing and is drowned. And Salish, who's the medicine chief, goes to examine him.
There is no sound in the body. There is no light in the eyes. He will move no more.
And then in jumps our hero, Captain James T. Kirk of the USS Enterprise, even though that's not who he knows who he is yet. But he may not know who he is, but he sure knows how to perform mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, which he does. And he brings the boy, quote-unquote, back to life. Everyone in the tent is shocked, especially Salish.
Do you think, by the way, because he does mouth-to-mouth, mm-hmm, but then he also does this weird leg-bending compression thing.
Yes.
Do you think that they went, we need a more sci-fi, it has to be like mouth-to-mouth, but not like mouth-to-mouth, and that's why they came up with this thing?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, what do you think, Becky?
I don't know. I mean, it just was so odd because you're like, oh, he's doing CPR. I'm sure that's tried and true. We all know that works, but then he started rubbing his leg and lifting it up, and I'm like, this is bizarre. But maybe that makes sense, that maybe they decided that they needed it to be more like, if we've evolved, that it also includes this maneuver.
But by the way, and any doctors can correct me because I might be wrong, but my memory of my Boy Scout life-saving classes was, if someone's drowned, you should clear the airway first, as they might have water in their lungs. So blowing air into their lungs that are filled with water is actually not what you should be doing first. At least that's my memory from Boy Scout camp circa 1984.
Well, I think that's a legitimate question, though, because when Kirk was performing the mouth-to-mouth on the boy and he started making the motion with his legs and kind of rubbing his legs to get circulation back into him, I guess, I was like, I don't remember that part of mouth-to-mouth, but
no.
Maybe because I was not a Boy Scout. Sorry.
Needless to say, when the question is, are you a god, is there... And Kirk, by the way, has not made the Ghostbusters mistake. He has not said no. is that if you immediately breathe life into a boy who comes back to life, I think your God cred has gone up.
Yeah.
So sure. they pretty much believe it. And not only that, they immediately say, give him the medicine badge.
Poor Salish. My heart just, every time I watch this episode, my heart breaks for Salish, who has to take off his medicine badge around his head and give it to Kirk.
Miramani comes and takes it off and puts it on Kirk. Well, here's my question about it. So yes, we feel bad for Salish. How is Miramani feeling at this moment that she is not betrothed to Salish?
Well, that's a really good question, because I think there's something alluded to towards the end of the episode that makes me think that Miramani was tied to Salish because of routine, because of tradition. But I don't think she ever really loved him.
That's totally what I think. Yeah. I don't think she dug him at all. And I think at this moment she's going, yes. You know?
Yeah, she was very quick to, it's this guy now.
She's like, okay. Here we go.
We're back on the Enterprise. Again, Spock is demanding full power for their deflectors. Scotty is grumpy about it. And he's even going,
all right, you lovelies, hold together.
We start to do it, and the power starts dropping, and the lights go dark.
Engineering, maintain full power. Full power.
And by the way, this asteroid that the Enterprise approaches, if it looks familiar, especially if you've seen these episodes hundreds of times like we have, it's the same asteroid that is used as the artificial world of Yonata in For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky, the longest title of the original series.
Yeah, and so they did save a little bit of money by getting to reuse that thing.
Yeah, they sure did.
Needless to say, we pushed the engines too far. It didn't deflect this asteroid enough. And so his plan is basically to get right in the thing's path and basically go in reverse in front of it.
And that brings us to the end of Act One. And I have a question. So when we were on the planet before they beamed up to get to the deflection point, Spock just outlines this whole thing, like Becky pointed out, where he's using a rock to illustrate how much the asteroid has advanced just in the time that he's explaining the situation to McCoy on why they have to get back to the Enterprise in the first place. But they still got back to the Enterprise in time, according to the calculations that they had. But what we're finding out now is that they were too late. They were too late. Do you think that Spock is feeling guilty? Do you think that Spock's motion to move the Enterprise in front of the asteroid and hopefully blow it to smithereens with their phasers was an act of desperation, almost like the one that he pulled at the end of the Galileo 7?
So first of all, as we said many times, I think both you and I, Scott, think that what he did at the end of the Galileo 7 was the most logical thing to do. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't think this is an act of desperation. I think he's making a calculated risk. Does he feel guilty? Maybe. But I actually think, so here's my construction of the events, which is that they needed to leave in 30 minutes, but they didn't. They left in 45 minutes or an hour.
Right.
And that led them to use up more warp power to push the engines farther than they were able to, which is what led to them not being able to deflect the asteroid. And so to me, I think Spock has made the best possible decisions he could have made this whole way, and now he is making the next best possible decision. That's
my opinion.
What's
your take on this, Becky?
Yeah, I think so too. It's a bummer. I'm glad he's not blaming Bones for like, ugh, I were late because I had explained this to you, and the time I had explained this, now we've lost a minute. Astra's here, not here. But I think there's a lot of weight on him because obviously Jim's his closest friend, and he wants to. I think that he's got a lot of pressure on him, so I think he's trying to just push them as hard as it can go and hope for the best, and feel like logic could work out. And it's really kind of heartbreaking when it doesn't.
Right, sure.
We're back in Act Two, and Miramani is bringing some water from the lake, and there is Salish, and this is the. I don't think he fully got it when she took the medicine chief symbol from him, because he comes up to her and basically like, hey, shouldn't you be getting ready for our wedding?
Yeah.
She's like, no, we're not getting married.
What do you mean? Tribal priestess.
and Medicine Chief are always joined.
He is Medicine Chief now.
That's funny how she throws out tradition here. She's like, oh, it's tradition. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. Can't make it happen.
Well, and she basically gives him, you know, there's other fish in the sea. And then this is the moment. And it's just a reaction shot. There's just a kind of a look from her. But I think if you watch her look, you know her answer. He asks,
Miramani, if you could choose, would you choose me?
Oh. And she gives a look and she walks away.
It's brutal.
And that answers the question that you asked before. She was not into Salish.
She's not into him.
Yeah. No, that's pretty brutal though.
I mean, you're in a small village. People don't usually, I mean, I'm assuming there's not a whole lot of choosing who you get to marry. So she just got a win, basically.
Yeah.
Kirk is working on a lamp and Miramonte enters and she bows to him.
Perhaps you would like to bathe now.
Oh, okay, sure.
She is fascinated with his shirt. She just is like, how does this come off? What's happening? Yeah. Like she's working on a shirt for like 5 minutes, it feels like.
Which is like,
to take it off.
Let's get your damn clothes off.
Miramonte, tell me about the wise ones.
Tell? But a god knows everything.
Not this one.
And then she explains, the wise ones brought us here from far away. They chose the medicine chief to keep the secret of the temple and to use it when the skies darken.
Why doesn't Salish use it? Why are the people in danger?
And this is where we get to what we were discussing earlier, mm-hmm. that dad didn't share the secret. And then as we're talking about this, in comes Goro, the elder.
Our people rejoice and wish to honor your name. But I did not know what you wished to be called.
And he thinks.
Kirk.
And we're going, dude, it's Kirk. Your name's James T. Kirk. You introduced yourself like 900 times in the course of the series.
I don't know how many times I've seen this episode. Every single time I get to that moment, I just want to go, say it, it's Kirk. But I gotta say, Becky, don't you think that Shatner's performance, I mean, I know you know we talked about his performance being great, but I think his performance in this particular moment is really on point. Because it's restrained. He's like still confused and he doesn't know who he is. And it's like something as simple as what is your name? And he still just it's affecting him. I think he's great, exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah, it was very effective. He's so good at, I mean, people, like I said, people criticize him for over emoting, obviously, but I think he's good at nuance and he's good at being restrained. And I think he's good at being, generally showing his emotions from within and also being a ham if he wants to be too. But I think this scene is great. And how awesome is the name Kirok? Like who came up, like that's just a great name. It fits so, it really fits. It's a great name that they chose.
I like when Goro says, is it Kirok? Okay, that works for me.
Sounds great. Sure.
And then we hear, and he's thinking about that name because he's like, no, that's not exactly my name. And they think he's displeased.
No, everything's fine.
And it must be ourselves, the way we live. Perhaps we have not improved as quickly as the wise ones wish.
And I think Kirk's response is totally fascinating because it is the antithesis of Kirk philosophy throughout the entire original series.
Your land is rich, your people happy. Who could be displeased with that?
And it's like, well, you messed up the place with the apple. You destroyed this side of paradise. You continually have said man's got to struggle. He's got to advance. He has to drive forward or he's not even being alive. And here he says, the land is rich. The people are happy. Who could be displeased with that?
And guess what, Steve? I'm glad you brought that up. I was kind of thinking along the same lines, but not in the way that you just put it, which is right on point. So my question for you and for Becky is this. If we go back to the apple and Kirk took the Valiance out of paradise, if we go back to Omicron Seti 3, and he took the settlers of Omicron Seti 3 out of paradise, regardless of how the settlers, the colonists were being infected by spores and not acting on their own, on their own free will, or the Valiants were being run by a machine, you know, for the purpose of just only feeding the machine. Take all that out. So if this version of Kirk that we are seeing here is saying everything is great here, you're peaceful, you're happy, what could be better than that? Maybe Steve and Becky, maybe the version of Kirk that we saw in those previous episodes is being driven by duty, mm-hmm. whereas now that duty has been stripped of him because his memory has been stripped of him, and this is truly who Kirk is at his soul.
Oh, wow.
Which is why in episodes like this and Balance of Terror, we see that he is longing for something simpler. He has been longing for something simpler all along, but it is his devotion to his duty and to his ship and his crew that has made him take the actions he did in the past.
I love what you just said there, Scott. And I'm really thinking about it. And I think you kind of have just helped me put my finger on something about Kirk. I mean, it's crazy to me that here we are 59 episodes into the original series. We've been hanging out with this Kirk guy a lot. We've talked about Kirk endlessly, and I feel like I'm still discovering stuff. Mm-hmm. And here is what you just helped me to understand, I think, which is that what we should say about Kirk, as amazing as he is, he's not perfect. He doesn't actually have it all figured out. So when he makes that speech at the end of This Side of Paradise, that's his justification for what he just did. That's him like, well, because he says, well, maybe we weren't meant for this. Maybe we were meant to march to the drum or whatever it is that he's wrestling with these ideas. He had to get them off the planet with the Volians and in the Apple, because the Enterprise was going to be destroyed and they were all going to get killed. So right. He had to do that. And then he had to kind of justify what they had done. But maybe what we're seeing in this moment is him is like, oh, it's not actually simple. These aren't simple questions. There's not a right or a wrong answer here. Mm-hmm. There is complicated answers. And that Jim Kirk is a person who absolutely believes in duty and absolutely wishes there was a beach to walk on. And those are both true.
Yeah,
absolutely. Becky, what's your take on that?
I just think this is Zen-like Kirk. and you're right. Maybe this is who he really is. I mean, without the responsibilities and not having to worry about that. Like, it takes a, you know, an act of like an advanced civilization to give him 2 months of just complete bliss, you know, really. And that he like can't, and even later when he can't escape his responsibilities, like it's still haunted in his dreams of like, I think I'm supposed to be somewhere else, but it's like a haunting thing, not like something he wants to go back to. I just think he can't escape his responsibilities, and ultimately it's a bummer for him. But I think this could really be what he really wants. And he actually gets to experience 60 days of bliss and knowing that this is what he wants. And then he dared to enjoy it. And then he's got to experience heartbreak for the rest of his life because of it.
That's a great point. And Steve, you have said many times that Kirk is a tragic figure.
Yeah.
And like, what could be more tragic than having to constantly, just like Spock has two sides, his human side and his Vulcan side, we are seeing, certainly I'm seeing now for the first time after all these decades of being a crazy Star Trek fan, that Kirk is also wrestling with two sides of himself, the side of him that is absolutely devoted to his duty, protecting his ship and his crew, prioritizing his ship and his crew when what he really wants is something very, very different. And this episode, the duty is taken from him because his memory is taken from him.
Right.
And we see that for the first time in his life, he is happy.
But his self-conscious won't let it go.
Yep.
His dreams.
Yep. It's funny. Two different thoughts. The first is, think about what was going on at the beginning of Shore Leave, which is that Jim Kirk had to be forced to take a break. A guy who has to be an exhausted guy, who they say is short of temper and down on efficiency, who has to be forced to take a break, that guy is actually not perfectly healthy. You know what I mean? Like, that is a driven person who isn't actually dealing with his needs the way he should be. That's the first thought. The second thought is, I think it's totally accidental, but the fact that there is an episode, This Side of Paradise, whereas the one time Spock felt happy and the paradise syndrome is the one time Kirk felt completely happy, is there's something there.
Oh,
something
I like that.
There. You just blew my friggin' mind.
Yeah.
You blew my mind. Spock says at the end of Paradise Syndrome, for the first time in my life, I was happy. And what does Kirk say in the other Paradise episode, the Paradise Syndrome? He says, I'm not sure, but I think I've never been happier. Aww. Wow. Wow. Okay. Holy Toledo. That's awesome.
All I can tell you is that I'm happy and peaceful here. I'm not sure, but I think I've never felt that way before.
Wow. You just linked the Paradise Syndrome to this side of paradise. You just linked Kirk to Spock in so many ways.
Why are they so sure I can help them?
Well, you came from the stone metal. Did you not bring life to the child?
Yes, but I...
And the music that plays, there's a subtly Star Trek-iness to it as he's going, I need time to remember. It isn't exactly the Star Trek main theme, but it's related to it. And I think that's a really, really great choice. Mm-hmm. And I also love, she says,
here there is much time.
And very tentatively, she touches him.
For everything.
We're back on the Enterprise.
Lock all phases on that mark. Maximum intensity, narrow beam. I want to split that fissure wide open.
You sound like you're cutting a diamond.
Very astute, Doctor.
And we're firing the phasers, and Scotty goes,
parents, my poor parents.
Scotty complains a lot in this episode, but that's okay.
Yeah. Well, and it might be that he's complaining all the time when Kirk is doing this stuff. He's just off camera, yeah. You know? Now Kirk wakes up, and now he is dressed in native clothes, and Miramani is there.
If it pleases you, I would like to name the joining day.
The joining day.
I'm the daughter of the chief. Tribal law betroths me to our leader. If there's another, I will step aside.
It's quite a moment for, basically, he didn't know they were getting married, you know?
Yeah. But now that he's finding out, and he finds out, you know, tomorrow, he's all for it.
I mean, the line, you know, Scott, you always talked about, you know, I remember what the line is, but from Conscience of the Kings, galaxies may collide or whatever. You could quote it.
Worlds may change, galaxies disintegrate, but a woman always remains a woman. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because even though Kirk has lost his memory, even though right now he is Kirok, he is so charming. He's so charming with Miramani.
No, Miramani, there's no one else in my mind or my heart.
Oh. And the look that he gives her. Right, Becky? Doesn't it just make your heart melt?
Oh, yeah. I put the quote in bold, in red, in my notes. It was so beautiful. And it was heartbreaking. And not heartbreaking, but just like heartwarming. He genuinely looks like he just is so in love. And it's such a beautiful thing to say to her.
And it's also, you know, we've talked, Becky, so many times about Jerry Finnerman, the cinematographer for the original series. And even though he did leave in the third season, he was still with us for the Paradise Syndrome. And this scene in particular is beautifully, beautifully shot, beautifully lit. And, the way that Shatner is framed in this scene, I think then, and Steve, you know, you brought up that moment from Conscience of the King. I think this is just as effective, even though Kirk doesn't have all his bearings. Instinctively, it's still who he is, that he is just that guy. He's that charming.
Well, and the moment of the Conscience of the King on some level is Bull. He is manipulating someone to get information.
True.
This moment, I think, and this is where, you know, Becky, you said at the beginning, Shatner's performance. I think him in this romantic role, he's amazing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it is simple and honest. It feels totally, totally real and true to me. I think and it's funny because there are two, I would say this and obviously City on the Edge of Forever are the two really great love stories in the original series. And this one, I think City on the Edge of Forever is a better episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I am more involved in this love story.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. And I'm saving a pretty big question for both of you. And I feel like I want to ask it now, but I'm going to wait till the very end.
All right, you save.
Of our conversation. I'm saving it.
It's really beautiful when Miramani says, the sooner a happiness together begins, the longer it will last. Is just what you say when you're just in love. Like, let's unite now and we'll just have a forever together. It's really romantic.
And we cut to an image of the obelisk on a monitor on the Enterprise, and we're hearing Scotty say,
"And don't ask for any more warp 9 speeds, Mr. Spock. Our star drive is completely burned out. The only thing we have left is impulse power.
Estimated repair time.
Hang on here in space? Forever!
Forever!" I think McCoy has a really good transition later in this episode, but at this moment, he is still all over Spock.
Yeah.
He's being really hard on him. Yeah.
Well, Spock, you took your calculated risk in your calculated Vulcan way, and you lost. You lost for us, you lost for that planet, and you lost for Jim.
It's like, ouch. Dude.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, get off my back, will you?
I know. He's like,
it is.
And then he's like, you need a rest.
But honestly, he does treat Kirk that way. There are definitely times where he's all over Kirk, whether it was in Obsession or things like that, where he's all over Kirk in the same way. And what we find out is that getting back to the planet without warp speed will take months. And he says,
"Exactly 59.223 days, Doctor. And that asteroid will be 4 hours behind us all the way."
Wow. Mm. Wow. That's really, really unique you know, we're going to advance, you know, basically flash forward 2 months in an episode of the original series.
"I haven't heard a word I've said. All you've been doing is staring at that blasted obelisk."
"Another calculated Vulcan risk, Doctor."
One thing I think Spock should be doing, which he isn't, and this is not a criticism of the episode, but this is what he should be doing, is saying, "Hey, all the research labs on the Enterprise, all of us should be working together to try to translate these things. It shouldn't just be me sitting by myself in my room for 2 months." It seems
we should all be losing sleep over this, figuring this out.
They have a couple of historians. You know, they had Marla MacGyver's, and then they had, but Lieutenant Palamas and Humor's Adonais, like, don't they have someone like a linguist? I mean,
well, they've talked about language. Yeah, they've talked about language departments and things like that. Well, and later on Star Trek, we know that Uhura is a master of a billion languages, but that didn't exist at this point yet.
Right. Yeah.
And we're getting ready for the wedding, and Salish is watching from a distance, not that happy. Kirk is at the obelisk getting some face paint on him.
"You will wait until I walk the holy path to the Earth Lodge first, to give me time to tell the priestess that you follow and that the joining will take place."
And he exits. And this is the moment where I don't like what Shatner does. I don't know if it's his fault. I don't know who told him to do this, but the big happy pantomime gestures while we hear the voiceover talking about how happy he is, I don't like.
See, now this is a point where, so Fred Freiberger said, I don't think Shatner's really expressing enough how happy he is. I'm like, are you kidding?
"I have found paradise. Surely no man has ever attained such happiness."
I get what's going on. I don't need those huge gestures to know that Kirk is happy. If he had just smiled, it had a private moment, I don't need the voiceover. I get it. Because you sold me in the other scenes.
Got it.
But now he is walking the path back for the day of joining, and there is Salish with a knife.
And Salish is like, you know, you took everything from me.
He did.
Yeah, he did.
"Even though you be a god, Kirok, I cannot permit this joining."
"Nobody's asking for your permission."
"Then you must strike me dead."
"I have no intention of striking you dead."
And Salish lunges and catches Kirk on the hand, and Salish says,
"You bleed. You bleed, Kirok. Behold a god who bleeds."
And that is the end of Act 2. Act 3, we come right back to the same spot. He repeats that same line, "Behold the god who bleeds." And then he attacks him. Kirk
does the drop kick.
Yeah.
"Kill me, Kirok, or I will not rest until I prove to my people that you are no god."
And what does Kirk do? What does Kirk do? He tosses the knife.
Yeah.
And he shows mercy and compassion. And not that he was going to kill Salish like he was almost going to kill the Gorn or almost going to kill Wyatt Earp in Spectre of the Gun. But he's like, I'm not going to kill you because, again, even though he lost his memory, his instinct, his nature is he's not going to kill today.
Yep. And then he heads off and basically gets married.
Yeah.
We're back on the Enterprise. And this is, you know, this is where the budget is clearly small because we're just in Spock's quarters. Like, we're basically not going to leave there at all.
I thought you were reporting to sickbay.
There isn't time, Doctor. I must decipher those obelisk symbols.
You've been trying to do that ever since we started back to that planet. 58 days.
I'm aware of that, Doctor. I'm also aware that when we arrive at the planet, we'll have barely 4 hours to effect rescue.
And now, it's what's so interesting is in the 2 months off camera, McCoy has changed what he thinks.
Well, my diagnosis is exhaustion, brought on from overwork and guilt. You're blaming yourself for crippling this ship just as we blamed you. But we were wrong. So are you.
Yep, he has a turn. Thanks, McCoy. Yep, he turns around.
You made a command decision. Jim would have done the same.
I think that's great because, I mean, how many of Kirk's decisions were ones where it was a huge gamble that happened to pay off, you know?
Oh, sure. He got lucky, you know? Sure, absolutely.
And Spock made a gamble and it didn't pay off.
My prescription is rest. Now, do I have to call the security guards to enforce it?
And Spock reacts to it. We hear the music. He gets up. He walks over to the bed. He lies down. McCoy, satisfied, exits. The door closes. Spock gets up and goes right back to work.
Yep.
He's obsessed.
We hear Mira Monomy laughing, and we're in a long lens as Kirk chases her shirtless through the trees.
Now this is just like 2 months have passed on the Enterprise. 2 months have now passed on the planet. And Kirk Kirok's sideburns are not pointed like Kirk's were when they first beamed down. Because this time has passed, Kirok is now sporting squared sideburns because he doesn't know what a Starfleet-issued pointy sideburn is. But this is actually the moment where it hit me this time watching Paradise Syndrome, where I thought about this being a companion episode to The Inner Light. And just like I have this feeling about The Inner Light, it also struck me about Paradise Syndrome, and this is my thought. So, of course, we go back and forth between the planet and the Enterprise because we want to see what the Enterprise is going to do with the asteroid and deflect the asteroid. But what if from the moment Spock and McCoy beamed back to the Enterprise in the first act, what if we never left the planet? What if we were on the planet for the entire duration of this episode until Spock and McCoy beamed back down 2 months later? You know, we don't know what happened in space. Maybe we didn't really need to be on the Enterprise, but what if we are just fully immersed in Kirk's, aka Kirok's, immersion into this society, into this culture, that we are really feeling like maybe this will be his life for the rest of his life? You know, like we're completely absorbed by this culture. And when we see Spock and McCoy reappear towards the end of the episode, we're like, oh yeah, oh, Kirk does not get happiness after all. Uh-huh. Like, we know that Spock and McCoy and the Enterprise is going to come back for Kirk. We know that he is going to be taken out of paradise. But I think that would have had a bigger impact if we were really consumed and absorbed by Kirok's paradise this entire time, never having the abrupt shift back to the Enterprise, taking us out of the moment and staying in that moment the entire time. I think that would have been a very interesting take on this episode.
Yeah.
I'm 100% sold. Not only do I think that's a great idea, I don't think there's anything we would have missed. Mm-hmm. I think it would have been super involving because all you had to do, what does Spock say when he shows up at the very end? These symbols are musical notes. Mm-hmm. I've spent a lot of time deciphering them.
Yeah.
So we don't have to see any of this stuff on the Enterprise. Like, and I actually think it would have been really interesting of here's how I would rewrite a little bit more of it is at the beginning, we don't see the native people at all. We hear that they're native people. Kirk, Spock and McCoy are gone. Kirk falls down into the thing and he emerges. And that's the first moment we see the native people. We don't know anything. Kirk might've gone back in time. He might've been transported. We have no idea what the hell's going on and just spend the whole hour with Kirk until McCoy and Bones show up again at the end.
Right.
I think that's I think that would be an amazing episode. I think it is something they wouldn't have done in 1968. It's a little too daring, but I love it, Scott. I love it.
What do you think, Becky?
I think that's great. I think you've been fully immersed. in it and not being taken away to see what's on the ship. And because I don't know if we needed any of that character development on the ship. I think you're right. They could have just covered it when they landed. It would have been fully immersive.
The reason I actually brought this up and in the first place is because, you know, when I saw you back a couple months ago at the Skirball Cultural Center for that Star Trek marathon. So the second day we showed The Inner Light. And while I was watching The Inner Light, and you know, there are those moments when they go back to the Enterprise with Riker and Crusher and Troy and everybody. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wouldn't this have been more interesting, more immersive if we just stayed on the planet with Picard and you really get the sense that you're living out this life, this other life of Picard's, like totally forgetting about the Enterprise. So that's why during my rewatch of The Paradise Syndrome, I thought about the same thing. What if we just stayed with Kirok this whole time, forgot about the Enterprise, and then suddenly, you know, just in the nick of time, as fate would have it, they show up and you're like, oh yeah, yeah, they came back. Good news, but bad news.
Yeah. And then I think you're the viewer is put in the mind of Kirk, like he forgot about them and we're forgetting about them. And then he's like reminded of his responsibilities at the end. And maybe it's more heartbreaking.
Exactly. Exactly. Well,
and you have a little bit more time for Salish and Miramani and the relationships that he's developing there.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes.
No. Brilliant, Scott. I love it.
Each time your arms hold me is as joyous as the first.
I'm happy. I'm so happy.
The scene is so romantic and so lovely with Miramani and Kirk at this moment.
If it weren't for the dreams, my mind would be completely at peace.
I thought you no longer had the dreams. That you no longer saw the strange lodge which moves through the sky.
Here's a thought. Has this thought ever occurred to you that the reason that the dreams went away and the reason the dreams are now coming back is that the Enterprise was far away and now the Enterprise is back closer?
I never thought of that. Oh, but wow. Well, so what you're saying is that there is actually a connection between Kirk and the Enterprise.
Always had that thought. I don't think there's anything to it necessarily, but I've always had that thought.
That's so great. I love that.
Wow. I love it too. And no way did I ever think of that. But oh yes, does that make sense? That the Enterprise, as the first love, the true love of his life, is coming back, moving back towards him, that he's feeling it. But I also think that there's something kind of chilling in the way that Miramani describes the lodge that moves through the sky, and the way that Kirk is saying, I have these visions of these two people, two faces. I feel like I should know them. I feel like my place is with them. And the way that Kirk is saying this, it's like he's, I don't know. He pauses, like he's trying to find the right words, and like he's scared. He's scared because maybe this destiny is going to take away his happiness.
Yeah, and he actually says, I don't deserve this happiness. Like he kind of knows I'm not supposed to be, this isn't my path. I'm not supposed to have this happiness.
Right. Right.
I've always interpreted it as it's that sense of duty. It's that underlying sense of duty. That's just, it's still there. He knows he's supposed to be doing something. By the way, I had the thought of these two faces. Wouldn't it be funny if the two faces that he keeps dreaming about are Chekhov and Nurse Chapel? No. Oh, one other thing, by the way, during this scene is just, I don't know if you noticed it, there is a bug crawling on Shatner's face.
On his forehead. Yeah.
Dude, yeah. Trying to act when you have, I've had this happen, been on a camera when there was a bug on me, and you just got to go like, don't ruin the take.
I have a gift for you.
Gift? What?
It may make you happy.
And she goes away and she comes back with a basket and he gives her a sort of, what's that? And she says,
I bear your child.
And his reaction and his smile and the kiss and the laughter and the note I wrote down as I'm looking at this lovely romantic scene, I wrote down, man, this really is tragic.
Yeah,
it really is. I mean, Becky, we are seeing Kirk, even though he's not all there, we are seeing him married, and we are seeing him in the throes of becoming a father. Mm-hmm. That is something we never saw before or since with Kirk. That just brings the stakes, the tragic stakes, elevated higher than City on the Edge of Forever. The emotional, the romantic stakes. I mean, obviously, you know, fixing the timeline of the future, you know, is a big deal. Right. But in terms of his love of his life, I mean, he's about to have a, he's going to be a father. Kirk is going to be a father. He's already a father because somewhere out there is David Marcus.
Literally was just about to ask that question. Has David Marcus already been born at this point?
Oh, well, I'm going to say yes because Steve Morris. So in Star Trek II, Kirk says, there's a man I haven't seen in 15 years who's trying to kill me. So this episode, The Paradise Syndrome, takes place after Space Seed. But if Space Seed was 15 years before Wrath of Khan, and David Marcus is clearly older than 15 years old, yeah, then yes, David Marcus is out there in the world, but Kirk doesn't know about that yet.
Well, I don't know that Kirk doesn't know about David Marcus.
Well, maybe you're right, because he says, is that David?
Yeah. I think he knew David was booked, because there's the conversation. Again, this is not in this episode, because David Marcus does not exist in the Star Trek universe idea yet. But he says, you know, she says, you know, I wanted him in my world. It was clearly a discussion they had when David was born that he was going to go with Carol. But anyway.
That's why the listeners love this show, for conversation like that.
Yeah. It's later. We're inside their hut or whatever. He's digging in the dirt, talking about his plans for a canal. And we just see how their relationship is going. And then as they kiss, we hear thunder.
Uh-oh.
It's only the wind. And the thunder.
I act like a stupid child. I have nothing to fear. You are here.
And there's more wind, and she says, it is time.
It is time indeed. And every time I watch this episode, and we're at this moment, this really tender moment between Kirk and Miramani. And by the way, the scene where Kirk is describing how to build the aqueduct and the lamps, that scene was added into the screenplay by Arthur Singer, who was the story editor in the third season. Now, you know, when we think back to the first and second season and all the contributions that Dorothy Fontana made as story editor, well, Dorothy Fontana left the show as story editor after the second season, and Arthur Singer came in through Fred Freiberger, and this was actually a really good scene that he added. And then just at that moment of tenderness and affection, you hear the thunder, you hear the winds, and I think to myself every single time, I go, uh-oh, honeymoon is over.
But it's only the wind, Aunt Harlow.
The wind is only the beginning. Soon the sky will darken, the lake will go wild, and the earth will tremble. Only you can save us.
But I can't do anything about the wind, the sky.
And this is where we hear that his job is to go inside the temple and make the blue flame come out. And now Goro shows up and wants him to be at the temple.
If you do not rouse the temple spirit, we will all die.
I have a question. The way that Kirok turns his back on Miramani and Goro, and he walks away from them, what do you think of Shatner's performance in this moment where he goes, but I don't know how to enter the temple? Like, I think that Shatner's performance in this episode is so fully realized. Becky, what's your take on this moment with Shatner and with Kirok? And he's, you know, he had all this happiness and now he's having all this responsibility thrust on him.
Right.
And he doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, I think he's freaking out. Like, he feels like, oh no, I'm going to disappoint them. I don't know how to do this. I'm not who you thought I was, and thought that he would be able to proceed with his life without not having to prove anything. And now I think it does look like he's so confused and lost.
Yep.
And it is a really effective job at that.
I will take it a step further, which is that what we have seen, Kirk's basic character is, I will always choose duty over love. I will choose duty over happiness. The moment that he showed up with his people, they kept calling him a god. They said things, you're going to be the medicine chief, and you're going to, those are all duty things. Mm. And he has ignored them. Mm. He didn't go, whoa, 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 because there was talk about him going in and out of the temple before. He has not said, I'm not a god. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to be the medicine. He hasn't said any of those things. I think because he was just so damn happy that for the first time in his life, he wasn't choosing duty. And now this is the moment where he goes, I failed.
Like, right. Or he just, it's really interesting because if Kirk has had the duty aspect of his life stripped away because his memory is lost, how much of that duty, of that devotion, of that, you know, his captaincy is part of his memory. Because if he doesn't have his memory and he's choosing happiness in this episode, and now that he's having duty thrust upon him, well, and that duty is not bringing back the memory of the duties he's had all this time before that. Mm-hmm. So how much is duty tied to memory, I guess, is the question.
Well, this goes into, it was funny, I was just listening to, it was a Great Courses, where it is a guy talking to a philosopher using science fiction to talk about philosophy. That is, and in fact, there was an episode where he talks a lot about Star Trek, which Scott, I was going to send to you. But what he literally, there was a whole lecture talking about whether or not memory is in fact who we are. Could we take someone's else's memories, and would that make us them, or would we still be you? And where is your identity fixed?
Wow.
What is your, in terms of consciousness versus memory versus all this stuff? This episode's not about that, but it certainly is a thing. Like, how much is he still Kirk without his memories?
Mm-hmm. You know? Exactly.
Needless to say, the person who is most tough on Kurok at this moment is Salish.
Well, what do you wait for, God? Your ropes?
And so we're back at the obelisk. It's windy, really windy. They got some big wind machines out there. And Kirk is up there banging on the walls of the temple.
I am Kirok! I am gone!
He's like helpless. Like, he's, what do I do? How do I help these people? What is my purpose here? I mean, like, the way he just is, he's so defeated. What an arc for this character of Kirok in just a couple of acts. It's really something.
And Salish is watching him and just starts to laugh. We're in Act 4. We're back to Spock's quarters. McCoy enters. Apparently, nobody has to knock. People could just walk into other people's rooms.
Yeah.
And he says, I prescribe sleep. And Spock is playing his, what's the instrument? Is it?
The Vulcan lyre?
The Vulcan lyre, that's right. He's playing his Vulcan lyre.
Were you able to make any sense out of the symbols?
Yes, the obelisk is a marker, just as I thought. It was left by a super race known as the Preservers. They passed through the galaxy rescuing primitive cultures which were in danger of extinction and seeding them, so to speak, where they could live and grow.
I've always wondered why there were so many humanoids scattered through the galaxy.
Let me ask you a question. Are the Preservers,
yes,
an extension of Sargon?
So that is literally what I was writing down. I think maybe. Well, and there's also Apollo. But I definitely think that on this planet they drop some native people and they put an obelisk to deflect asteroids, and on another planet they put another bunch of people, and instead of an obelisk they put a big serpent. The thing is that there is a headman on the Apple who gets talked to by Vol, who, when he has to know important stuff, Vol tells him the important stuff he has to know. Mm-hmm. Here, there's the medicine chief, who's the keeper of the information. And I'll tell you another thought that I had, which is that, okay, they have planets where the people are in trouble and they rescue them and take them somewhere else. Do they take them somewhere else on something that looks like an asteroid on the outside, but is actually hollow, and there are people being transported to a new planet where the Preservers, people who are taking the world is hollow and I have touched the sky, people to their next planet?
All right, Becky, what's your take on all that? Because that is that's a whole lot of
I actually never thought of it before, but that sounds great. Like, wow. Maybe they put us on this planet.
this is
very, by the possible.
Way, this is what we do here on Enterprise Incidents.
Yeah, you blow everyone's minds. Wow.
That is absolutely, if you're talking about, McCoy is validating that he always wondered why there were so many humanoids throughout the galaxy. And you have basically looked at taking similarities, by the way, between the Apple and the Paradise Syndrome and validating it to suggest that maybe the Preservers are the reason that the Valiants exist in the first place.
Here's another question for you. Okay. Is it possible that another name for the Preservers is actually there was a guy named Hodgkins who was putting all these people on different planets, and that's how it got the name of the Law of Parallel Development?
I think that's a little bit more of a stretch. I like your other idea much better.
All right, fair. We're back at the obelisk, and the villagers have showed up with rocks, and they start to stone him, and Miramani is calling to help him, and they throw her up on the temple with Kirk. And they start to throw stones at both of them. And Kirk tries to protect her. She goes down. Spock and McCoy materialize. And all of the natives run away. And they run up to Kirk. This might be, by the way, the worst version of Dr. McCoy being a terrible doctor. They do very little to help. He does call for Nurse Chapel.
My wife. Is she all right?
Wife?
Their first response is hallucinations.
Why were you being stoned?
Kurok could not get back into the temple.
Naturally, since he did not come from there.
McCoy's diagnosis is his brain is unimpaired. Everything else is functioning normally except his memory. So what are we going to do? The Vulcan mind fusion. Have we ever heard it called the Vulcan mind fusion before?
No, Becky, have you?
No.
The Vulcan mind fusion. But this, I think, is one of the most powerful mind melds that we've seen in three seasons of Star Trek. And the way that when Spock starts the mind meld and the way he draws Kirk out, he goes, I, and they both say at the same time,
I am
Kira.
And Spock is definitely connected. He's getting through to Kirk and he's saying, I am. And he's trying to say Kirk and Kirk is going, I am Kirok. I am. And then suddenly you hear
Spock
and Spock comes out of it.
What is it? His mind. He's.
And he pauses.
An extremely dynamic individual.
And is it me? Or when Spock says those words, he is, and he pauses, an extremely dynamic individual. Is Spock on the verge of tears?
Aww.
I don't know if he's in, I think he's been over. So before we answer that question, I want to back up. What is happening when they're saying, I am Kirok together, and Spock is going, and then finally says, I am Spock?
I feel like Kirk is fighting back. Yes. He wants to keep Kirok. He wants to keep his happiness and he's fighting it. And
I agree.
Yeah. That's what I think is happening.
I think it's more than that. It is exactly what I think is happening. I think Kirk isn't just fighting back. Kirk is winning.
Yeah.
Kirk is overpowering Spock.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk is because Spock, he is forcing Spock. Spock's trying to get Kirk to be like, you're Jim Kirk. And Kirk is forcing Spock to say, I am Kirok.
Kirk, it's a powerful scene.
Overwhelming Spock. And here, this goes back to the very beginning of Enterprise Incidents, way back in The Enemy Within, when we first started talking about this and we first started discussing when Kirk has to bring these two selves back together and the act of will it took, the act of character it took to do that, and that experience gave him the strength to deal with the naked time and get himself under the control. And that gave him the strength to deal with Dagger of the Mind, where he was being mind controlled into loving Dr. Noel and all that. When I first had that thought, when we were talking about Enemy Within, the episode I was thinking the most about was Paradise Syndrome and this moment.
Wow. Wow.
Is that the guy who learned to bring himself together and develop that mental discipline, that freedom from the spores in this side of paradise, that is the guy that Spock is coming up against. The person who is desperate, has the power to hold his whole psyche together, is now going to overwhelm Spock. That is where this comes to. That is why he is an extremely dynamic individual, because of all those experiences.
Becky, what's your take on that? That's beautifully said. Beautifully said.
I don't want to add anything.
Well, I think to your point, Becky, I think that Kirok is fighting back.
Yeah.
Because Kirok doesn't want to lose his happiness. And Spock is bringing Kirk back, bringing back the duty, bringing back the burden. And there is definitely a conflict there. And I think that Spock, like you said, Steve, Spock is overwhelmed. I think there's a little bit of an emotion there where Spock says he's composing himself. That's why he pauses and he says, an extremely dynamic individual, but it worked.
And I think Shatner plays really well. I remember who I am. I know that I have a duty and I have stuff to do. The woman I love is lying, dying next to me. Mm-hmm. He's playing both of those things really well. You know, Spock kind of gets him up to speed that this is a deflector, that it's musical notes.
You mean entry can be gained by playing certain notes on a musical instrument?
That would be one method. Another would be a series of tonal qualities spoken in their proper sequence.
And Kirk thinks for a moment and then says, give me your communicator.
Kirk to Enterprise.
Hi, Captain.
So the sound of the communicator followed by the musical tones, Kirk to Enterprise, that's what activated the door to open the obelisk. That is so fascinating. That talk about, forget Hodgkins' law of parallel developments, in all of the universe, that just coincidentally, the same exact language that Kirk uses to hail the Enterprise five times in each and every episode, preceded by the tone of the communicator flipping open, that is the musical note that activates the door to enter the hatch, enter the obelisk. I just, that is so fascinating to me.
Well, here's a question. Is this a crazy coincidence or is this destiny? Did the preservers know that Kirk would come?
Oh, wow.
Oh, fate.
Fate. Becky, what do you think?
I don't know. I hadn't thought of it before, but I think that's really beautiful. I like that.
I don't like fate stories as much, although I'm a big Stephen King fan and he loves fate stories. So, but I don't think that's such a Star Trek thing as much, but you know, he shows up looking like a god. I mean, everything leads to this is what saves the planet.
Well, I'm a Terminator fan, so no fate, but what you make. So anything has to do with fate, I'm in.
But also, if the preservers are that powerful, then they might have also the power to see into the future.
Maybe.
And that is a very valid point. That is an extremely valid point that opens the scope of this story of the Paradise Syndrome in incredible ways that really are incredible.
By the way, one thing that is not done correctly is that he calls up and Scotty answers and says, "Hi, Captain," instead of, "Oh my God, Captain, you're alive. We didn't know."
He found you.
They spent 2 months thinking he was dead, you know, but the door opens. I like that Miramani's on it when it opens. I think that's a nice touch.
Scotty, if the deflector isn't activated within 20 minutes, get out of orbit. The landing party's expendable. The Enterprise isn't.
And then turns his attention to Miramani just for a moment to kiss her.
Bones, stay with her. Do what you can.
Which, by the way, he's doing nothing. He's just standing there. He does nothing to help her at all.
Oh, jeez. Poor McCoy.
But we go inside.
Careful. I must have hit something accidentally. A beam caught me, and that's when I stopped remembering.
Probably a memory beam. You must have activated it out of sequence.
Okay, this was the big thought that I was saving till the end. A memory beam you activated out of sequence. What is a memory? What do you think a memory beam is?
I never thought about a memory beam. Well, maybe the memory beam is what Salish would have activated if he knew how to get into the obelisk. Mm. So that he learns how to, you know, operate the machinery and deflect the asteroid. Yes.
This is exactly the thought that I had. Mm-hmm. And this is where I went, is like, okay, this is something that can put scientific knowledge into your brain, like maybe a thing you would put on your head that would teach you how to remove a brain, where it's also a society that a much more highly technologically advanced society set up, a society that isn't that advanced, but has a way to tell them stuff, just like Vol can tell the leader of Vol information through his little antenna. Again, we have, and also in The World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky is also a society that isn't terribly advanced, that is being led by much more advanced technology.
Absolutely.
So then Spock goes off on a long lecture about musical notes, and finally Kirk interrupts and says, "Spock, just press the right button."
And that made me think, of Star Trek the Motion Picture, where he goes, "Spock, transmit now."
And they fire a big beam out at the asteroid, and it totally works. Good job.
Good job. The planet is saved, but that is not the end of our story.
Because we're back in his home in the hut, and McCoy is with Miramani, and Kirk says, "How is she?"
"She had bad internal injuries, Jim."
"Will she live?"
"No."
And I'm like, the medical power on the Enterprise. Yeah, right. She got hit with a bunch of rocks. They would be doing, I mean, like, if she was brought into the ER here, they would be doing stuff. Like, it seems, but that is what it is.
She doesn't have, like, you know, cuts and bruises on her body. No. At all. Yeah.
No, I mean, like, you know, so what? So, I mean, we can replace spleens and, you know, kidneys and dialysis. There's all sorts of medicine that we could do today that McCoy's doing nothing. But this is what the episode is.
Yeah, yeah.
Because she has to die.
Yeah.
But he goes to her. He holds her. This last scene is lovely.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Yeah. "I will bear you many strong sons. I love you all.
And I love you, Miramani."
And she dies, and the camera holds on Kirk's sadness, looking down at Miramani, and then you see the words, "Produced by Fred Freiberger. And then the Enterprise goes off into space. So here's the question I've been saving for both of you for this moment. Okay? So the question is, Kirok was absolutely in love with Miramani. Mm-hmm. Did Kirk love Miramani?
Yes, 100%, totally.
Tell me why.
Why not?
Why not? You think that Kirk?
Well, let me ask. Let me,
the way that Kirok loved Miramani.
Let me ask you. Let me, because maybe I need to clarify your question. Are you? Do you think that Kirk and Kirok are? Does Kirk have all of his Kirok memories?
I think Kirk has his Kirok memories, but when he got his memories back, I think all of his memories came back. His love of the Enterprise, maybe his love of Edith Keeler. So much of him comes from his memories and his duty. And well, let me ask Becky. Becky, do you think that clearly knows there's no question that Kirok was in love with Miramani? Was Kirk also in love with Miramani? Did Kirk love Miramani the same way that Kirok loved
No, her? I don't think so. I think it's evident at the end of the episode. Like, she dies in his arms, but it doesn't seem as heartbreaking as it would have been, I think, earlier. Like, he really, like, he's kind of like, all right, like, I don't know, not like it's okay, but he definitely doesn't seem as connected as he was earlier.
He doesn't have the tragic, completely devastated expression that he had at the end of Sitting on the Edge of Forever.
Yes.
What I think, the reason I ask this question is because I think that Kirk loved that Kirok loved Miramani. I think Kirk cares for her a great deal. I mean, whether or not he was fully there for these 2 months, I think that he does love her, but I think that he loved how much Kirok was in love with her. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately he cared about her a great deal, but I'm not getting the same, like, if Miramani died in the arms of Kirok, I think we would have seen that devastation.
Yeah.
But we're not seeing that devastation from Kirk. I think Kirk is realizing that he is absolutely not, you know, would never have stayed there. But what's interesting is that in an earlier version of the screenplay, Kirk actually brings, first of all, Miramani survives with Kirk's child. You know, she's still pregnant with Kirk's child. And Kirk brings Miramani to the Enterprise. But then Miramani gets to the Enterprise and she's like totally freaked out by this advanced technology. She wants to go back and be with her people. And Kirk is heartbroken about losing her and his unborn child. And he tells her, tell him, assuming it's a him, tell him he's of two worlds with a proud heritage of both worlds. But that's an alternate ending in which Miramani lived.
That ending.
Yeah, I'm glad they didn't do that. So you've given me some time to think now about your question. Here's what I think. First of all, it's surprising to me that I, who am not generally the most romantic person, have the most belief in Kirk's love for Miramani at the end of this. Here's how I see it, which is, like, I'm sure you both have at some point gone on a vacation or been on a job out of town and made a connection with a person that really wasn't going to happen in the real world. And then you're kind of back, and that connection's still totally real. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, that's how I feel. I think he still 100% totally loves Miramani just the way he did before. But his memories and his duty and the presence of McCoy puts a shield over it. He pushes it down because that's what Kirk does.
Right.
Is that he can't express or show it the way he could before because of all his other duties and memories and responsibilities and relationships. So, like, I think it's still 100% totally real. And the one other thing just in regards to Edith Keeler is the difference with Edith Keeler and why I think he has that expression. He didn't just watch her die. He let her die.
That's good.
He was responsible for her death. In his mind, he essentially killed her in his mind, you know, so that is that's why that is so intense on him.
Certainly.
One more thing I want to say, we've talked forever endlessly about Jerry Finnerman. The lighting, though, in this space when her body is laid out and he's over her, it might be my favorite of all of his lighting in the whole series so far. It's so painterly.
Yep.
It is very much, you could see the Renaissance paintings he's referencing for this particular lighting. It's absolutely beautiful.
Well, there you go. That's a hell of a conversation.
Yeah.
What was there other conversation about the Paradise Syndrome? Did other people have something to say about it?
Well, William Shatner definitely had an affinity for Paradise Syndrome. He felt that the episode was extremely good. However, Fred Freiberger, the producer throughout the third season, said, quite frankly, I wasn't happy with the show. It didn't come out as well as I expected. But Margaret Armin, who wrote the screenplay, said, I think if Gene Roddenberry had been producing, the episode would have been a lot better. But who could say? People loved it. I heard from the sponsors that their wives adored it.
Aw.
I'll just give my final thoughts quickly. It's a really strong episode. And what's to the strongest thing about it is just Shatner's performance and the world that's created in that relationship. I think it totally, the Spock and McCoy stuff is fine. But I'm completely involved in the relationship with Kirok and Miramani, and it is a truly tragic ending. Mm-hmm. That's how I feel about it.
Yeah,
absolutely. Becky, what's your final take on the Paradise Syndrome?
I think it's wildly romantic. It was just so amazing to revisit it. And I think it is one of Shatner's best episodes. He gets to show so much of his range and his depth and just different emotions, like the frustration and the confusion and then just euphoria of falling in love. I just think it's an extraordinary episode. I am more drawn to the love story in City on the Edge of Forever because he's tempted to sacrifice the future of humanity for her. And and I don't know, it really feels really I earned at the end too. And then I used to at the end of this episode is a little bit like, he's not as heartbroken, but it's a strong episode. And it's a gorgeous, it's a beautifully looking episode. And I'm so happy I got to talk more about it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, I absolutely love the episode. And like so many of the conversations, Steve, that we've had on this podcast, it's opened my mind and my eyes to things about it that I never really considered. and really, really thought about, but that is the purpose of Enterprise incidents. And I have to say that, you know, linking the preservers to so many of these episodes just does make a whole lot of sense. And I just, there are so many episodes of Star Trek that can be described as unique because it was the only time they ever attempted something like this. But this is definitely one of them. Mm-hmm. And so much so that the score was hardly ever reused. But it is absolutely a beautiful episode. Becky, I think you're absolutely right. I think this is one of Shatner's finest performances throughout Star Trek because he did display so much range and that it is such a sad, heartbreaking ending, even though I still feel like that Kirok was in love with Miramani. Mm-hmm. And Kirk loved that. So my question actually for everybody, all the Enterprisers listening to Enterprise Incidents, is was Kirk in love with Miramani, or did he love that Kirok was in love with Miramani? Head to our Facebook page and let us know what you think of that revelatory moment. Well, Steve, what other episodes of your other podcast, The Cinephiles, kind of goes along with the theme and the story of the Paradise Syndrome?
Well, I was thinking about that. And the one that I came up with is one I don't think I've ever mentioned on Enterprise Incidents. But since we're talking about Native Americans and we're talking about a romantic but somewhat hopeless love story, The Last of the Mohicans, Michael Mann's film with Daniel Day-Lewis, seemed to fall into that category. So we did that a couple of years ago, one of John's absolutely favorite movies. And, you know, I like it too. And if you want to follow Enterprise Incidents, Scott already mentioned our Facebook page. There's action going on there all the time. You can follow the show on Twitter at Enter Incidents, on Instagram at Enterprise Incidents. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, where you should leave your reviews. In fact, I think you should leave a 5-star review. Of course, if you really wanted to leave a lower review, you could do that too, but we prefer 5 stars. You could go on YouTube and subscribe to the show there and leave your comments. And most importantly, if you want to support the show, you can do it through Anchor, which is our podcast host. And the easiest way to do that, right on this episode, you can click on the description, and in the show notes is a link to Anchor where you can subscribe to Enterprise Incidents for as little as 99 cents a month. That is not even like less than a cup of coffee. That you can't even buy a video game for 99 cents anymore. If you could find an arcade where you could play one. We think of it as a tip jar. We really appreciate your support there. Scott, how would people find you?
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Movie Mance. And like Steve said, be sure to head over to our Facebook page. I'm posting stuff on our page all the time. And if you follow us on Facebook, our Facebook page, Enterprise Incidents, you'll be the first to know breaking news about upcoming episodes and guests for Enterprise Incidents. And like Steve said, I'm just going to second this. Please do give a review, write a review on Apple Podcasts about Enterprise Incidents. And like Steve also said, look, we love doing this show. It is a true labor of love, but labor is the key word. We put a lot of work into this week after week. So if you could support us through Anchor, through the link that is listed in the description of this podcast episode, we would be so, so, so very, very grateful. And Becky, Deanna, I have to say thank you for joining us as our guest for our deep dive of the Paradise Syndrome. Hope you enjoyed yourself. Where can people follow you and find you on social media?
Oh, sure. I so enjoy doing this. And you guys have so many romantic stories ahead of you, because I think over the course of the 79 episodes, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy all fall in love at least once. And I think, McCoy, Scotty, and Spock are, you know, for future episodes, you're going to have to tackle.
Oh, yeah.
Three. That's so right. Exciting. You can find me on Twitter at Hollywood Minotaur. And that's H. Wood Minotaur. If you go to my Twitter page, you'll get a link to my website, which has got all my podcast appearances. I've done some on the, I did a big episode on the original series and Next Gen. But also there's if you're into Ingmar Bergman, I have like 20 Ingmar Bergman episodes. So really there's something for everybody on there. And I wanted to ask you guys this trivia question, which you probably will know. Because my job is working with third-party brands and tying them in with movies, do you guys know McDonald's first Happy Meal movie promotion, what it was?
A McDonald's? Was it Star Trek the Motion Picture?
Yes, it was.
Nice work.
That was impressive.
Very impressive.
My faith in Scott Mance continues to be well rewarded.
Yes. Well, Becky Diana, thank you so, so very much. And coming up on the next episode of Enterprise Incidents, it's our namesake episode, The Enterprise Incident,
wow,
where Kirk gets pointed ears and acts like a Vulcan to steal the Romulan cloaking device. Spoiler alert. But The Enterprise Incident is a beloved episode. It is next on Enterprise Incidents. So join us. And until then, keep going boldly.